his glasses before he delivered bad news. "I am sorry, Miss Sunderling," he said. "There is nothing I can do." He held up a hand, stopping her before she could interrupt. "I am a private detective," he continued. "It is true that the police have often asked me to help them with their inquiries, but in this country I have no official status. That is the problem here. It is much more difficult for me to impose myself, particularly in a case like this, where, to all intents and purposes, no crime has been committed. I have to ask myself on what pretext I would be able to enter Pye Hall. I must also take issue with your basic proposition. You tell me that Mrs. Blakiston was killed as the result of an accident. The police evidently believe so. Let us assume that it was an accident. All I can do, then, is to confront the gossip of certain villagers in Saxby-on-Avon who have overheard an unfortunate conversation and have made of it what they will. But such gossip cannot be confronted. Rumors and malicious gossip are like bindweed. They cannot be cut back, even with the sword of truth. I can, however, offer you this comfort. Given time, they will wither and die of their own volition. That is my opinion. Why do you and your fiancé even wish to remain in this part of the world, if it is so disagreeable to you?
Why should we have to move?
I agree. If you would take my advice, it would be to stay where you are, to get married, to enjoy your lives together. Above all, ignore this. I believe the word is tittle-tattle. To confront it is to feed it. Left alone, it will go away. There was nothing more to be said. As if to emphasize the point, Fraser closed his notebook. Joy Sunderling got to her feet. "Thank you very much, Mr. Pond," she said. "Thank you for seeing me." "I wish you the very best, Miss Sunderling," Pund replied, and he meant it. He wanted this girl to be happy. During the entire time he had been talking to her, he had forgotten his own circumstances, the news he had heard that day. Fraser showed her out. Pund heard a few brief mutters, then the front door opened and closed. A moment later, he came back into the room. "I say, I'm terribly sorry about that," he muttered. "I was trying to tell her that you didn't want to be disturbed." "I am glad I saw her," Punt replied. "But tell me, James, what was the word that I saw you underscoring several times as we spoke?"
"What?"
Fraser flushed. "Oh, actually, it wasn't anything important. It wasn't even relevant. I was just trying to look busy." "It struck me that might be the case."
"Oh? How?"
"Because at that moment, Miss Sunderling was not saying anything of particular interest. The motor scooter, though, had it been any color but pink, it might have been significant." He smiled. "Could you bring me a cup of coffee, James? But after that, I think I do not want to be disturbed." He turned and went back into his room. Chapter 3 Joy Sunderling made her way back to Farringdon Tube Station, her path taking her round the side of Smithfield Meat Market. There was a lorry parked outside one of the many entrances, and as she went past, two men in white coats were bundling out an entire sheep's carcass, raw and bloody. The sight of it made her shudder. She didn't like London. She found it oppressive. She couldn't wait to be on the train home. She had been disappointed by her meeting with Atticus Punt, even though, she admitted it now, she had never really expected anything from it. Why should the most famous detective in the country be interested in her? It wasn't even as if she would have been able to pay him. And what he had said had been true. There was no case to solve. Joy knew that Robert hadn't killed his mother. She had been with him that morning, and would certainly have heard him if he had left the house. Robert could be moody. He often snapped out, saying things that he regretted. But she had been with him long enough to know that he would never hurt anyone. What had happened at Pye Hall had been an accident, nothing more. All the detectives in the world would have been no match for the wagging tongues of Saxby-on-Avon. Still, she had been right to come. The two of them deserved their happiness together, Robert in particular. He had been so lost until he had met her, and she wasn't going to allow anyone to drive them apart. They weren't going to move. They weren't going to take any notice of what people thought of them. They were going to fight back. She reached the station and bought a ticket from the man in the kiosk. Already a thought was taking shape in her mind. Joy was a modest girl. She had been brought up in a very close and, despite her father's politics, conservative family. The step that she was now considering shocked her, but she could see no other way. She had to protect Robert. She had to protect their life together. Nothing was more important than that. Before the tube train had arrived, she knew exactly what she was going to do. Chapter 4. In a restaurant on the other side of London, Francis Pye cast a careless eye over the menu and ordered grilled sardines, a salad, a glass of white wine. Carlotta's was one of those family Italian restaurants behind Harrod's. The manager was married to the chef, and the waiters included a son and a nephew. The order was taken, the menus removed. She lit a cigarette and leant back in her chair. "You should leave him," her lunch companion said. Jack Dartford, 5 years her junior, was a darkly handsome man with a moustache and an easy smile, dressed in a double-fronted blazer and cravat. He was looking at her with concern. From the moment they had met, he had noticed something strained about her. Even the way she was sitting now seemed nervous, defensive, one hand stroking the other arm. She had not taken off her sunglasses. He wondered if she had a black eye. "He'd kill me," she replied. She smiled curiously. "Actually, he did try to kill me in a way, after our last row." "You're not serious." "Don't worry, Jack. He didn't hurt me. It was all bluster. He knows something's up. All those telephone calls, days off in London, the letters. I told you not to write to me."
"Does he read them?"
"No, but he's not stupid. And he talks to the postman. Every time I've received a handwritten letter from London, he's probably heard about it. Anyway, it all came to the fore over dinner last night. He more or less accused me of seeing someone else."
"You didn't tell him about me."
"Afraid he'll come after you with a horsewhip. I wouldn't put it past him. But no, Jack, I didn't tell him about you."
"Did he hurt you?"
"No."
She took off her sunglasses. She looked tired, but there were no bruises around her eyes.
"It was just unpleasant. It's always unpleasant where Magnus is concerned."
"Why won't you leave him?"
"Because I have no money. You have to understand that Magnus has a vindictive streak the size of the Panama Canal. If I tried to walk out on him, he'd surround himself with lawyers. He'd make sure that I left Pye Hall with nothing more than the clothes I was wearing."
"I have money."
"I don't think so, darling. Certainly not enough."
It was true. Dartford worked in the money market, which in the true sense wasn't really work at all.
He dabbled. He made investments.
But recently he'd had an unlucky streak, and he very much hoped that Francis Pye had no idea how close he was to rock bottom. He couldn't afford to marry her. He couldn't afford to run away with her. The way things were going, he could barely afford lunch. "How's the south of France?" he asked, changing the subject.
That was where they had met, playing tennis together. "It was boring. I'd have much preferred it if you'd been there."
"I'm sure. Did you get in any tennis?"
"Not really. To be honest, I was quite glad to leave. We got a letter in the middle of the week. A woman at Pye Hall had tripped on a wire, fallen down the stairs and broken her neck."
"My God, was Freddy there?"
"No, he was staying with friends down in Hastings. He's still there, as a matter of fact. He doesn't seem to want to come home."
"I don't blame him. So who was she?"
"The housekeeper. A woman called Mary Blakiston. She'd been with us for years, and she's going to be almost impossible to replace. And that wasn't the end of it. When we finally got back last Saturday,
We discovered we'd been burgled.
No.
I'm telling you. It was the groundsman's fault. At least that's what the police think. He'd smashed a pane of glass at the back of the house. He had to do it to let the doctor in.
Why did you need a doctor?
Pay attention, Jack. It was for the dead woman. Brent, the groundsman, had seen her through the window just lying there. He called the doctor and the two of them broke into the house to see if they could help. Well, obviously, there wasn't anything they could do. But after that, he just left the door with its broken pane. He didn't even bother to get it boarded up. It was an open invitation to burglars, and the burglars accepted it, thank you very much.
Did you lose very much?
Not personally, no. Magnus keeps most of his valuables in a safe, and they couldn't open that. But they marauded through the place, did quite a bit of damage. Pulled open drawers and scattered the contents, that sort of thing. Oh, it took all of Sunday and yesterday to clear it up. She reached out with the cigarette, and Dartford slid an ashtray in front of her. I'd left some jewelry beside the bed, and I lost that. It makes you feel uneasy, thinking you've had strangers in the bedroom.
I'll say.
And Magnus lost his precious treasure trove. He wasn't at all happy about that.
What treasure was that?
It's Roman, mainly silver. It's been in the family for generations, ever since they dug it up on their land. It came from some sort of burial site. There were rings, armlets, some decorative boxes, coins. We had it in a display case in the dining room. Of course, he'd never had it insured, even though it was meant to be worth a fortune. Well, it's a bit late now.
Were the police helpful?
Of course not. We had some chap come over from Bath. He sniffed around, wasted a lot of fingerprint powder, asked impertinent questions, and then disappeared, completely useless.
The waiter arrived with a glass of wine. Dartford had been drinking Campari and soda. He ordered another. It's a shame it wasn't Magnus, he remarked, once the waiter had gone.
What do you mean?
The lady who fell down the stairs. It's a shame it wasn't him.
That's a dreadful thing to say.
I'm only saying what you're thinking, darling. I know you well enough. I assume you'd inherit the whole caboodle if Magnus popped his clogs.
Francis blew out cigarette smoke and looked curiously at her companion. As a matter of fact, the house and the grounds would all go to Freddy. There's some sort of entail on the estate. It's been that way for generations.
But you'd be all right.
Oh, yes. And of course I'd get a lifetime interest in Pye Hall. The only thing I couldn't do is sell the place. But it's not going to happen. Magnus is in perfect health, certainly for his age.
Yes, Francis, but a big house like that, a wire stretched out across the stairs. You never know what might happen. Maybe those burglars of yours could return and finish him off.
You're not serious.
It's just a thought.
Francis Pye fell silent. This wasn't the sort of conversation to be having, particularly in a crowded restaurant. But she had to admit that Jack was right. Life without Magnus would be considerably simpler and a great deal more enjoyable. It was just a shame that lightning didn't have the habit of striking twice. On the other hand, though, why not? Chapter 5. Dr. Emilia Redwing tried to see her father once a week, although it wasn't always possible. If the surgery were busy, if she had home or hospital calls to make, if there was too much paperwork on her desk, then she would be forced to put it off. Somehow it was always easy to make an excuse. There was always a good reason not to go. She derived very little pleasure from the visits. Dr. Edgar Renard had been 80 years old when his wife had died, and although he had continued living in his home in nearby King's Abbot, he had never really been the same. Emilia had soon got used to the telephone calls from the neighbours. He had been found, wandering in the street. He wasn't feeding himself properly. He was confused. At first, she had tried to persuade herself that he was simply suffering from chronic grief and loneliness. But as the symptoms had presented themselves, she had been forced to make the obvious diagnosis. Her father had senile dementia. He wasn't going to get any better. In fact, the prognosis was a great deal worse. She had briefly considered taking him in with her at Saxby-on-Avon, but that wouldn't have been fair to Arthur. And anyway, she couldn't possibly become an old man's full-time carer. She still remembered the guilt, the sense of failure that she had felt the first time she had taken him to Ashton House, a residential home converted from a hospital in the Bath Valley just after the war. Curiously, though, it had been easier to persuade her father than it had been to persuade herself. This wasn't a good day to have made the 15-minute drive to Bath. Joy Sanderling was in London, seeing someone on what she had described as a personal matter. Mary Blakiston's funeral had taken place just 5 days ago, and there was a sense of disquiet in the village that was hard to define, but which she knew from experience might well lead to further calls on her time. Unhappiness had a way of affecting people in just the same way as the flu, and even the burglary at Pye Hall struck her as being part of that general infection. But she couldn't put off the visit any longer. On Tuesday, Edgar Renard had taken a tumble. He had been seen by a local doctor, and she had been assured that there was no serious damage. Even so, he was asking for her. He was off his food. The matron at Ashton House had telephoned her and asked her to come. She was with him now. They had got him out of bed, but only as far as the chair beside the window. And he was sitting there in his dressing gown, so thin and crumpled that Amelia almost wanted to cry. He had always been strong, robust. As a little girl, she had thought the entire world rested on his shoulders. Today, it had taken him 5 minutes before he had even recognized her. She had seen this creeping up on them. It wasn't so much that her father was dying. It was more that he had lost the desire to live.
"I have to tell her," he said. His voice was husky.
His lips had difficulty shaping the words. He had said this twice before, but he still hadn't made himself understood. "Who are you talking about, Papa? What is it you have to tell?"
"She has to know what happened, what I did."
"What do you mean? What are you talking about? Is this something to do with Mama?"
"Where is she? Where is your mother?"
"She's not here." Amelia was annoyed with herself. She should never have mentioned her mother. It would only confuse the old man. "What do you want to tell me, Daddy?" she said more gently.
"It's important. I don't have very long."
"That's nonsense. You're going to be fine. You just have to try and eat something. I could ask the matron for a sandwich, if you like. I can stay here with you while you have it."
"Magnus Pye."
How extraordinary that he should have spoken that name. Of course, he would have known Sir Magnus when he worked at Saxby-on-Avon. He would have treated the whole family. But why mention him now? Was Sir Magnus in some way connected with what had happened? Whatever it was that her father had wanted to explain. The trouble with dementia was that, as well as leaving huge gaps in the memory, it also jumbled things together. He might be thinking of something that had happened 5 years ago or 5 days ago. To him, they were the same. "What about Sir Magnus?" she asked.
"Who?"
"Sir Magnus Pye. You mentioned him. There was something you wanted to tell me?" But the vacant stare was back in his eyes. He had retreated into whatever world it was that he inhabited. Dr. Emilia Redwing stayed with him for another 20 minutes, but he barely noticed she was there. After that, she exchanged a few words with the matron and left. She drove home with a nagging sense of worry, but by the time she had parked the car, she had put her father out of her mind. Arthur had said that he would cook the supper that night. The two of them would probably watch Life with the Lions on television and go to bed early. Dr. Redwing had already seen the surgery appointments list for the following day and knew that she was going to be busy. She opened the door and smelled burning. For a moment she was concerned, but there was no smoke, and the smell was somehow distant, more a memory of a fire than an actual one. She went into the kitchen and found Arthur sitting at the table, slumped there, actually, drinking whiskey. He hadn't even begun to cook the dinner, and she knew at once that something was wrong. Arthur did not deal well with disappointment. Without meaning to, he somehow celebrated it. So what had happened? Dr. Redwing looked past him and saw a painting leaning against the wall, the wooden frame charred, the canvas largely eaten away. It was a portrait of a woman. He had clearly painted it. She recognized his style immediately, but it took her a moment or two longer to realize who it was.
"Lady Pye," he muttered, answering her question before she had the time to ask it.
"What's happened? Where did you find it?"
"It was on a bonfire near the Rose Garden, at Pye Hall."
"What were you doing there?"
"I was just walking. I cut through Dingle Dell, and there was no one around, so I thought I'd stroll through the gardens down to the main road. I don't know what drew me to it. Maybe it was meant to be." He drank some more. He wasn't drunk. He was using the whiskey as a sort of prop. Brent wasn't around. There was no sign of anyone. Just the bloody painting thrown out with the rest of the trash.
"Arthur.
Well, it's their property. They paid for it. I suppose they can do with it as they want."
Dr. Redwing remembered. Sir Magnus had commissioned the portrait for his wife's 40th birthday, and she had been grateful at the time, even when she discovered how little Sir Magnus intended to pay. It was a commission. It meant so much to Arthur's self-esteem, and he had set about the work with enthusiasm. He had painted Francis Pye over 3 sittings in the garden, with Dingle Dell in the background. He hadn't been given nearly enough time, and to begin with, Lady Pye had been a reluctant sitter. But even she had been impressed by the result, a portrait that brought out everything that was good in her, and which showed her relaxed, half-smiling, in command. Arthur had been quietly satisfied with the result, and at the time so had Sir Magnus, hanging it prominently in his great hall.
"It must be a mistake," she said. "Why would they want to throw it out?"
"They were burning it," Arthur replied heavily. He gestured vaguely at the canvas. "He seems to have cut it to pieces first."
"Can you save it? Is there anything you can do with it?"
She knew the answer. The woman's imperious eyes had survived, the dark sweeping hair part of one shoulder. But most of the painting was blackened. The canvas had been slashed and burned. She didn't even want it in the house. "I'm sorry," Arthur said. "I haven't done the supper." He emptied his glass and walked out of the room.
Chapter 6.
"Have you seen this?"
Robin Osborne was reading a copy of the Bath Weekly Chronicle, and Henrietta had never seen him look so angry. There really was something quite Old Testament about him, she thought, with his black hair falling to the collar, his white face, his bright, angry eyes. Moses would have looked much the same with the golden calf, or Joshua storming the walls of Jericho. "They're going to cut down Dingle Dell."
"What are you talking about?" Henrietta had made 2 cups of tea. She put them down and moved further into the room.
"Sir Magnus Pye has sold it for development. They're going to build a new road and 8 new houses."
"Where?"
"Right here." The vicar gestured at the window. "Right at the bottom of our garden. That's going to be our view from now on, a row of modern houses. He won't see them, of course. He'll be on the other side of the lake, and I'm sure he'll leave enough trees to form a screen. But you and me..."
"He can't do it, can he?"
Henrietta went round so that she could read the headline, "New Homes for Saxby-on-Avon." It seemed to be a remarkably upbeat interpretation of such an act of vandalism. Her husband's hands were visibly shaking as he held the paper.
"The land's protected," she went on.
"It doesn't matter if it's protected or not. It seems he's got permission. The same thing's been going on all over the country. It says here that work will begin before the end of the summer. That means next month or the month after, and there's nothing we can do."
"We can write to the bishop."
"The bishop won't help. Nobody will."
We can try.
No, Henrietta, it's too late.
Later that evening, as they stood together preparing the supper, he was still upset.
This dreadful, dreadful man, he sits there in that big house of his, looking down at the rest of us, and it wasn't even as if he did anything to deserve it. He just inherited it from his father and his father before him. This is 1955, for heaven's sake, not the Middle Ages. Of course it doesn't help having the bloody Tories still in power, but you'd have thought we'd have moved away from the days when people were given wealth and power simply because of an accident of birth. When did Sir Magnus do anything to help anyone else? Look at the church. We've got the leaking roof, the new heating system that we can't afford, and he's never put his hand in his pocket to stump up so much as a shilling. He hardly ever comes to services in this, the very church he was christened in. Oh, and he's got a plot reserved in the cemetery. The sooner he inhabits it, the better, if you ask me.
I'm sure you don't mean that, Robin.
You're right, Hen. It was a wicked thing to say, and it was quite wrong of me.
Osborne paused and took a breath.
I'm not opposed to new housing in Saxby-on-Avon. On the contrary, it's important if the village is going to keep hold of its young people. But this development has got nothing to do with that. I very much doubt that anyone around here will be able to afford the new houses.
And you mark my words.
They'll be nasty, modern things, quite out of keeping with the village.
You can't stand in the way of progress.
Is this progress? Wiping out a beautiful meadow and a wood that's been there for 1,000 years? Frankly, I'm surprised he can get away with it. All the time we've been living here, we've loved Dingle Dell. You know what it means to us.
Well, a year from now, if this goes ahead, we're going to be stuck here next to a suburban street.
He put down the vegetable peeler and took off the apron he had been wearing.
I'm going to the church, he announced suddenly.
What about dinner?
I'm not hungry.
Would you like me to come with you?
No, thank you, my dear, but I need time to reflect. He put on his jacket. I need to ask for forgiveness.
You haven't done anything.
I've said things that I shouldn't have said, and I have thoughts in my head also that shouldn't be there. To feel hatred for your fellow man, it's a terrible thing.
Some men deserve it.
That is certainly true. But Sir Magnus is a human like the rest of us. I shall pray that he has a change of heart. He left the room. Henrietta heard the front door open and close, then set about clearing the kitchen. She was deeply concerned about her husband and knew only too well what the loss of Dingle Dell would mean to the two of them. Was there something she could do about it? Perhaps if she went to see Sir Magnus Pye herself. Meanwhile, Robin Osborne was cycling up the high street on his way to the church. His bicycle was something of a joke in the village, a terrible old bone rattler with wheels that wobbled and a metal frame that weighed a ton. There was a basket suspended from the handlebars, and it was usually filled with prayer books or fresh vegetables, which he had grown himself, and which he liked to distribute as gifts to poorer members of his congregation. This evening, it was empty. As he pedalled into the village square, he passed Johnny Whitehead and his wife, who were walking arm in arm, heading for the Queen's Arms. The Whiteheads did not often go to church, certainly not more than they had to. For them, as in so much of their life, it was a question of keeping up appearances, and with that in mind, they both called out a greeting to the vicar. He ignored them. Leaving his bicycle at the entrance to the cemetery, he hurried on and disappeared through the main door.
"What's wrong with him?" Johnny wondered out loud. "He didn't look at all happy."
"Maybe it was the funeral," Gemma Whitehead suggested. "It can't be very nice having to bury someone."
"Nah, vicars are used to it. In fact, they enjoy it. Funerals give them a reason to feel important."
He looked up the road. Next to St. Botolph's, the garage lights had flickered out. Johnny saw Robert Blakiston crossing the forecourt. He was closing for the night. He glanced at his watch. It was 6 o'clock exactly.
"Pub's open," he said. "Let's get in there."
He was in a good mood. Gemma had let him go to London that day. Even she couldn't force him to spend his whole life in Saxby-on-Avon. And it had been nice to return to a few haunts and to see a few old friends. More than that, he'd actually enjoyed being in the city with the traffic all around him and dust and dirt in the air. He liked the noise. He liked people in a hurry. He'd done his best to get used to the countryside, but he still felt that he had about as much life here as a stuffed marrow. Catching up with Derek and Colin, having a few beers together, wandering down Brick Lane, had been like rediscovering himself. And he had come away with £50 in his pocket, too. He'd been quite surprised, but Colin hadn't thought twice.
"Very nice, Johnny. Solid silver and a bit of age to it, too. Get it from a museum, did you?
You should visit us more often." Well, drinks were on him tonight, even if the Queen's Arms was about as cheerful as the cemetery it stood next to. There were a few locals inside. Tony Bennett was on the jukebox. He held the door open for his wife, and the two of them went in. Chapter 7 Joy Sanderling was on her own in the dispensary that also served as the main office at Dr. Redwing's surgery. She had let herself in with her own keys. She had keys to every part of the building, except for the cupboard containing the dangerous medicines, and even this she could open, as she knew where Dr. Redwing kept her spare. She had decided what she was going to do. The very thought of it made her heart beat faster, but she was going ahead anyway. She pulled a sheet of paper out of a drawer and fed it into the typewriter, the Olympia SM2 Deluxe model that she had been supplied with when she began the job. It was a portable. She would have preferred something a little heavier for all the typing she had to do, but it wasn't in her nature to complain. She looked down at the white page as it curved round towards her, and for a moment she thought of her arrival at Tanner Court and her meeting with Atticus Punt. The famous detective had disappointed her, but she felt no ill will towards him. It had been kind of him to see her, particularly as he hadn't been looking at all well. She was used to seeing sick people. Her time at the surgery had given her a sort of premonition. She could sense at once when something was seriously wrong, even before the patient had been in to see the doctor, and she had known at once that Punt was in need of help. Well, that wasn't any concern of hers. The fact was that he had been right. Now that she thought about it, she could see that it would have been impossible to stem the tide of vicious gossip within the village. There was nothing he would have been able to do. But there was something she could. Choosing her words carefully, she began to type. It didn't take her very long. The entire thing could be contained in 3 or 4 lines. When she had finished, she examined what she had written, and now that it was there, in black and white, in front of her, she wondered if she could really go through with this. She couldn't see any alternative. There was a movement in front of her. She looked up and saw Robert Blakiston standing on the other side of the counter in the waiting area. He was wearing his overalls, covered in oil and grime. She had been so focused on what she had been doing that he had entered without her hearing. Guiltily, she pulled the page out of the typewriter and laid it face down on the desk.
"What are you doing?" she asked.
"I came in to see you," he said. Of course, he would have only just shut down the garage, and he must have come straight here. She hadn't told him she was going to London. He would assume she had been here all day.
"What sort of day have you had?" she asked, brightly.
"Not too bad." He glanced at the face-down letter.
"What's that?"
His tone was suspicious, and she realized she had turned it over a little too quickly.
"Just something for Dr. Redwing," she said. "It's a private letter, medical stuff."
She hated lying to him, but there was no way she was going to tell him what she had written. "Do you want to go for a drink?"
"No, I ought to get back to Mum and Dad."
She saw a look pass across his face, and for a moment she was worried.
"Is something wrong?" she asked.
Not really. I just wanted to be with you. When we're married, we'll be together all the time, and nobody will be able to do anything about it.
Yeah.
She considered changing her mind. She could have gone out with him. But her mother had cooked a special dinner, and Paul, her brother, became agitated when she was late. She had promised she would read to him tonight, before bed. He always enjoyed that. Taking the letter with her, she got up and went through the door that connected the two areas. She smiled and kissed him on the cheek. "We're going to be Mr. and Mrs. Robert Blakiston, and we're going to live together, and we're never going to be apart again." Suddenly, he took hold of her. Both hands were around her, and the grip was so strong that he almost hurt her. He kissed her, and she saw that there were tears in his eyes. "I couldn't bear to lose you," he said. "You're everything to me. I mean it, Joy. Meeting you was the best thing that ever happened to me, and I'm not going to let anyone stop us being together." She knew what he meant. The village. The rumors.
"I don't care what people say," she told him. "And anyway, we don't have to stay in Saxby. We can go anywhere we want."
She realized that this was exactly what Pund had said.
"But we will stay here," she went on. "You'll see. Everything will be all right."
They parted company soon after that. He went back to his little flat to shower and change out of his work overalls. But she did not return to her parents. Not yet. She still had the note she had written. It had to be delivered. Chapter 8. At exactly that moment, and a little further up the road, Clarissa Pye heard someone ringing at her front door. She had been preparing her dinner, something quite new that had suddenly turned up in the village shop, frozen fish, cut into neat fingers and covered in breadcrumbs. She had poured out some cooking oil, but fortunately she hadn't yet popped them into the pan. The doorbell rang a second time. She laid the cardboard packet on the kitchen counter and went to see who it was. A shadowy, distorted figure could be seen on the other side of the granite glass windows set into the front door. Could it be a travelling salesman at this time of the night? The village had recently had a veritable plague of them, as bad as the locusts that had descended on Egypt. Uneasily, she opened the door, glad that the security chain was still in place, and peered through the crack. Her brother, Magnus Pye, stood in front of her. She could see his car, a pale blue Jaguar, parked in Winsley Terrace behind him. "Magnus?" She was so surprised she didn't quite know what to say. He had only ever visited her here on two occasions, once when she was ill. He hadn't been at the funeral, and she hadn't seen him since he got back from France.
"Hello, Clara. Can I come in?"
Clara was the name he had always called her, from the time they were children. The name reminded her of the boy he had once been and the man he had become. Why had he chosen to grow that awful beard? Hadn't anyone told him that it didn't suit him, that it made him look like some sort of mad aristocrat out of a cartoon? His eyes were slightly grey, and she could see the veins in his cheeks. It was obvious he drank too much, and the way he was dressed, it was as if he had been playing golf. He was wearing baggy trousers tucked into his socks and a bright yellow cardigan. It was almost impossible to imagine that they were brother and sister, and more than that, twins. Perhaps it was the different paths that life had taken them in their 53 years, but they were nothing like each other anymore, if they ever had been. She closed the door, released the security chain, then opened it again. Magnus smiled, although the twitch of his lips could have signified anything, and stepped into the hallway. Clarissa was going to take him into the kitchen, but then she remembered the box of frozen fish lying next to the hob and led him the other way instead. Left turn or right turn? Number 4 Winsley Terrace was not like Pye Hall. In this house, there were very few choices. The two of them went into the living room, A clean, comfortable space with a swirly carpet, a three-piece suite, and a bay window. There was an electric fire and a television. For a moment, they stood there, uncomfortably.
"How are you?" Magnus asked.
Why did he want to know? What did he care?
"I'm very well, thank you," Clarissa said. "How are you? How is Frances?"
"Oh, she's all right. She's up in London, shopping." There was another awkward pause.
"Can I get you something to drink?" Clarissa asked.
Perhaps this was a social visit. She couldn't think of any other reason for her brother to be here.
"That would be nice, yes. What have you got?"
"I have some sherry."
"Thank you."
Magnus sat down. Clarissa went over to the corner cupboard and took out a bottle. It had been there since Christmas. Did sherry go off? She poured two glasses, sniffed them, then carried them over.
"I was sorry to hear about the burglary," she said.
Magnus shrugged. "Yes, it wasn't a nice thing to come home to."
"When did you get back from France?"
"Saturday evening. We walked in and found the whole place ransacked. It was that damn fool Brent not fixing up the back door. I'm glad I've got rid of him. He'd been getting on my nerves for a while now. Not a bad gardener, but I never did like his attitude."
"Have you fired him?"
"I think it's time he moved on."
Clarissa sipped her sherry. It clung to her lip, as if reluctant to enter her mouth.
"I heard you lost some of the silver."
"Most of it, actually. To tell you the truth, it's been a bit of a trying time. What with everything else."
"You mean Mary Blakiston?"
"Yes."
"I was sorry not to see you at the funeral."
"I know. It's a shame. I didn't know."
"I thought the vicar wrote to you."
"He did, but I didn't get his note until it was too late. Bloody French post office. Actually, that was what I wanted to talk to you about."
He hadn't touched his sherry. He looked around the room, as if seeing it for the first time.
"Do you like it here?"
The question took her by surprise.
"It's all right," she said,
and then, more determinedly,
"Actually, I'm very happy here."
"Are you?"
He made it sound as if he didn't believe her.
"Well, yes."
"Because the thing is, you see, the lodge house is empty now."
"You mean the lodge house at Pye Hall?"
"Yes."
"And you want me to move in?"
"I was thinking about it on the plane home. It's a damn shame about Mary Blakiston. I was very fond of her, you know. She was a good cook, a good housekeeper, but above all, she was discreet. When I heard about this bloody accident, I knew she was going to be very hard to replace. And then I thought about you."
Clarissa felt a cold shudder run the length of her body.
"Magnus, are you offering me her job?"
"Why not? You've hardly worked since you got back from America. I'm sure the school doesn't pay you very much, and you could probably use the cash. If you moved into the lodge house, you could sell this place and you might enjoy being back in the hall. You remember, you and me chasing around the lake, croquet on the lawn? Of course, I'd have to talk about it with Frances. I haven't mentioned it to her yet. I thought I'd sound you out first. What do you say?"
"Can I think about it?"
"Absolutely. It was just a thought, but it might actually work out very well."
He lifted his glass, had second thoughts, and put it down again.
"Always good to see you, Clara. It would be marvellous if you moved back in."
Somehow, she managed to show him to the door and stood there watching as he climbed into his Jaguar and drove away. Clarissa's breath was not coming easily. Even speaking to him had taken a gigantic effort. She felt wave after wave of nausea spreading through her. There was no feeling in her hands. She had heard the expression, numb with anger, but she had never realized it could be a reality. He had offered her a job, working as his skivvy. Mopping floors and doing the washing up. Dear God! She was his sister. She had been born in that house. She had lived there until she was in her 20s, eating the same food as him.
She had only moved out after the death of their parents and Magnus's wedding, the two events following shamefully fast one upon the other. Ever since that day, she had been nothing to him. And now, this. There was a reproduction of Leonardo da Vinci's The Virgin of the Rocks in the hallway. The Virgin Mary might have turned her head from John the Baptist and looked in alarm as Clarissa Pye stomped up to the first floor with vengeance in her eyes. Certainly, she wasn't going there to pray. Chapter 9. By 8:30, darkness had fallen on Saxby-on-Avon. Brent had decided to work late. Quite apart from the lawns and all the weeding, there were 50 varieties of rose to be deadheaded and the yew trees to be trimmed. When he had docked the wheelbarrow and his various tools in the stable, he walked round the lake and out through Dingle Dell, following a path that would take him close to the vicarage and on to the Ferryman, the village's second pub, which stood at the lower crossroads. It was just as he reached the edge of the wood that something made him turn back. He had heard something. He quickly ran his eyes over the house itself, squinting through the darkness. There were a couple of lights burning on the ground floor, but no sign of any movement. As far as he knew, Sir Magnus Pye was in alone. He'd driven back from the village an hour ago, but his wife was away for the day, in London. Her car was still out of the garage. He saw a figure walking up the pathway from the main gate. It was a man, on his own. Brent had good eyesight, and the moon was out, but he couldn't be sure if it was anyone from the village. It was hard to tell, as the visitor was wearing a hat that concealed most of his face. There was something about the way he was walking that was a little odd. He was half stooping, keeping to the shadows, almost as if he didn't want to be seen. It was a late hour to be visiting Sir Magnus. Brent considered turning back. There'd been that burglary the same day as the funeral, and everyone was on the alert. It wouldn't take him a minute to go back across the lawn and check that everything was all right. He decided against it. After all, it wasn't any business of his who visited Pye Hall, and following the discussion he'd had with Sir Magnus that same afternoon, after what Sir Magnus had said to him, he certainly felt no loyalty towards his employer or his wife. It wasn't as if they'd ever looked after him. They'd taken him for granted. Brent had been working from 8 a.m. until the middle of the night for years now, with never a word of thanks, and at a salary that was frankly laughable. He wouldn't normally go drinking in the middle of the week, but as it happened, he had 10 bob in his pocket, which he was going to spend on fish and chips and a couple of pints. The ferryman stood at the bottom end of the village. It was a shabby, ramshackle place, much less genteel than the Queen's Arms. They knew him there. He always sat at the same seat near the window. Over the next couple of hours, he might exchange 6 words with the barman, but for Brent, that amounted to a conversation. He put the visitor out of his mind and continued on his way. He had another strange encounter before he reached the pub 25 later. As he emerged from the woods, he came upon a single, slightly disheveled woman walking towards him and recognized Henrietta Osborne, the vicar's wife. She must have come from her house, which was just up the road, and she had left in a hurry. She had thrown on a pale blue parka, a man's, presumably her husband's. Her hair was untidy. She looked distracted. She saw him. "Oh, good evening, Brent," she said. "You're out late."
"I'm going to the pub."
"Are you? I was just wondering. I was looking for the vicar. I don't suppose you've seen him?"
"No." Brent shook his head, wondering why the vicar would be out at this time of the night.
Had the two of them had a row?
Then he remembered. "There was someone up at Pye Hall, Mrs. Osborne. I suppose it might have been him."
"Pye Hall?"
"They were just going in."
"I can't imagine why he'd want to go up there." She sounded nervous.
"I don't know who it was." Brent shrugged.
"Well, good night."
Henrietta turned and went back the way she had come, heading towards her home. An hour later, Brent was sitting with his fish and chips, sipping his second pint. The room was thick with cigarette smoke. Music had been playing loudly on the jukebox, but there was a pause between discs, and he heard the bicycle as it went past, heading up towards the crossroads. He glanced out and saw it as it went past. The sound it made was unmistakable. So he had been right. The vicar had been down at Pye Hall, and now he was on his way home. He had been there for quite a while. Brent thought briefly about his meeting with Henrietta Osborne. She'd been worried about something. What was going on? Well, it was nothing to do with him. He turned away and put it all out of his head. But he would be reminded of it soon enough. Chapter 10. Atticus Punt read the story in the Times the following morning. Baronet murdered. Police were called to the Wiltshire village of Saxby-on-Avon following the death of Sir Magnus Pye, a wealthy local landowner. Detective Inspector Raymond Chubb, speaking on behalf of the Bath Constabulary, confirmed that the death is being treated as murder. Sir Magnus is survived by his wife, Frances Lady Pye, and his son, Frederick. He was in the sitting room at Tanner Court, smoking a cigarette. James Fraser had brought him the newspaper and a cup of tea. Now he returned, carrying an ashtray. "Have you seen the front page?" Punt asked. "Absolutely. It's terrible. Poor Lady Mountbatten."
"I'm sorry?"
"Her car was stolen, and in the middle of Hyde Park."
Punt smiled a little sadly. "That was not the story to which I referred."
He turned it round to show to his assistant. Fraser read the paragraphs. "Pye?" he exclaimed. "Wasn't that..."
"It was indeed. Yes, he was the employer of Mary Blakiston. His name was mentioned in this room just a few days ago."
"Quite a coincidence."
"It is possible, yes, coincidences do occur, but in this instance, I am not so sure. We are talking here of death, of two unexpected deaths in the same house. Do you not find that intriguing?"
"You're not going to go down, are you?"
Atticus Punt considered.
It had certainly not been in his mind to take on any more work. The time remaining to him simply would not allow it. According to Dr. Benson, he had at best 3 months of reasonable health, which might not even be enough to catch a killer. Anyway, he had already made certain decisions. He intended to use that time to put his affairs in order. There was the question of his will, the disbursement of his home and property. He had left Germany with almost nothing of his own, but there was the collection of 18th-century Meissen figurines, which had belonged to his father, and which had miraculously survived the war. He would like to see them in a museum, and had already written to the Victoria and Albert in Kensington. It would comfort him to know that the musician, the preacher, the soldier, the seamstress, and all the other members of his little family would still be together after he had gone. They were, after all, the only family that he had. He would make a bequest for James Fraser, who had been with him during his last 5 cases, and whose loyalty and good humour had never failed him, even if he had never helped very much when it came to the investigation of crime. There were various charities that he wished to benefit, in particular the Metropolitan and City Police Orphans Fund. Above all, there were the papers relating to his masterwork, The Landscape of Criminal Investigation. It would have taken him another year to finish it. There was no possibility of presenting it to a publisher in its present state. But he had thought that he might be able to collate all his notes, along with the newspaper clippings, letters and police reports, so that some student of criminology might be able to assemble the whole thing at some future date. It would be sad to have done so much work for nothing.
These had been his plans. But if there was one thing that life had taught him, it was the futility of making plans. Life had its own agenda. Now he turned to Fraser.
I told Miss Sunderling that I was unable to help her because I had no official reason to present myself at Pye Hall, he said. But now a reason has presented itself, and I see that our old friend, Detective Inspector Chubb, is involved.
Punt smiled. The old light had come into his eyes.
Pack the bags, James, and bring round the car. We are leaving at once.
Part 3. A Girl. Chapter 1. Atticus Punt had never learned to drive. He was not willfully old-fashioned. He kept himself informed of all the latest scientific developments and would not hesitate to use them, in the treatment of his illness, for example. But there was something about the pace of change that concerned him, the sudden onrush of machines in every shape and size. As televisions, typewriters, fridges and washing machines became more ubiquitous, as even the fields became crowded with electric pylons, he sometimes wondered if there might not be hidden costs for a humanity that had already been sorely tested in his lifetime. Nazism, after all, had been a machine in itself. He was in no rush to join the new technological age. And so, when he had bowed to the inevitable and agreed that he needed a private car, he had left the whole business to James Fraser, who had gone out and returned with a Vauxhall Velox, four-door saloon. A good choice, Punt had to admit. Sturdy and reliable, with plenty of space. Fraser, of course, was boyishly excited. It had a 6-cylinder engine. It would go from 0 to 60 in just 22 seconds. The heater could be set to de-ice the windscreen in the winter. Punt was just happy that it would get him where he wanted to go. And a sober, unremarkable grey, it would not scream out that he had arrived. The Vauxhall, with James Fraser at the wheel, pulled in outside Pye Hall after the 3-hour drive from London, which they had taken without stopping. There were 2 police cars parked on the gravel. Punt got out and stretched his legs, grateful to be released from the confined space. His eyes travelled across the front of the building, taking in its grandeur, its elegance, its very Englishness. He could tell at once that it had belonged to the same family for many generations. It had an unchanging quality, a sense of permanence. "Here's Chubb," Fraser muttered. A familiar face of the detective inspector appeared at the front door. Fraser had telephoned him before they left, and Chubb had evidently been awaiting their arrival. Plump and cheerful, with his Oliver Hardy moustache, he was dressed in an ill-fitting suit with one of his wife's latest knitting creations below, this one a particularly unfortunate mauve cardigan. He had put on weight. That was the impression he always gave. Punt had once remarked that he had the look of a man who has just finished a particularly good meal. He came bounding down the front steps, evidently pleased to see them. "Herr Punt," he exclaimed. It was always Herr, and somehow Chubb implied that there was some failing in Punt's character being born in Germany. After all, he might have been saying, "Let's not forget who won the war." "I was very surprised to hear from you. Don't tell me you've had dealings with the late Sir Magnus." "Not at all, Detective Inspector," Punt replied. "I had never met him, and only knew of his death from the newspapers this morning." "So what brings you here?" His eyes travelled over to James Fraser, and seemed to notice him for the first time. "It is a strange coincidence." In fact, Fraser had often heard the detective remark that there was no such thing as a coincidence. There was a chapter in The Landscape of Criminal Investigation where he had expressed the belief that everything in life had a pattern, and that a coincidence was simply the moment when that pattern became briefly visible. "A young lady from this village came to see me yesterday.
She told me of a death that had taken place in this very house 2 weeks ago. Will that be the housekeeper, Mary Blakiston?
Yes.